for a blue light. Ah, there we go. Welcome, everybody, to the February 22nd, 2016 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. We've got a very busy agenda today, and it is the last day that we can hear and move bills, so you'll pardon us if we move very quickly. We're going to start out with three House bills, actually, and then I think the main bill that people are probably interested in is House Bill 4036, which will take up where we left off last week. So we're going to start out with work session on House Bill 4039, open work session. That's one we've worked on before, and I think the amendments are ready that we've talked about.
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendment to House Bill 4039.
Senator Rodds moved the -2 amendments to House Bill 4039. Is there a discussion on that motion? Is there opposition to that motion? They're adopted. Senator?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4039 as amended with a -2 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Rodds moved House Bill 4039 as amended by the -2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to that motion? Motion is passed unanimously, and who would like to carry that?
If I may recommend Senator Johnson.
Senator Johnson will ask her to carry. We'll close on that. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4018A. And would you like to read this? Representative Escobar.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 4018A extends the sunset on provisions that prohibit annexation on specified lands in unincorporated Jackson County from 2016 to 2026. It declares an emergency if it takes effect upon passage. There's no amendment. It has no fiscal or no revenue impact, and the House floor vote was 57-2. Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is pretty simplistic. It is a carry-on. We have one that Senator Bates and I did 10 years ago that excluded this annexation by an unincorporated place called White City. In case they decide to incorporate, we didn't want them to take in this large industrial park. So that's why it's there. This is a little different than the one before in the aspect that we did cut out three businesses out of the Medford area and let Medford deal with that, which they have, and they've made an agreement. So pretty much everyone's for it.
Didn't think you'd be back here doing it again, huh?
No.
Something's never
And
nice.
I better not be back here doing the next one either.
Okay. Any questions of the representative? Seeing none, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Saperstein, are you here? There you are.
Chair Beyer, committee members, my name is Ralph Saperstein. I'm here representing Boise Cascade. I'll just answer any questions. Representative Escobar said it pretty.
Good bill should pass, huh?
Sounds like that.
There you go. I like that. Questions, Mr. Saperstein?
Well, and look at this.
And we'll get to the good senator.
I brought my staff guy.
Oh, that's interesting. Senator Bates.
For the record, Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Alan Bates. I'm a staff guy and do a little work as a senator once in a while, too, but not much, okay? I assume you've heard about this bill already. I'll just add that I sponsored this bill 10 years ago and got it through. It was basically just to grab into an industrial area trying to raise taxes without actually giving any more services and endanger some of our best employers in Jackson County. So we really wanted to get that bill through. I never in my wildest dreams thought I'd be here 10 years later, so I thought I was pretty well safe on this bill. We're going to put another 10-year sunset on it, and if I'm still here in 10 years, you guys got to dump me out of that wheelchair and take me somewhere, okay? It's a good bill. It should pass. It's worked well. We don't want our biggest employers in Jackson County having a burden. They give us great jobs, high-paying jobs. They're expanding again, and they're really for many areas, the backbone of our communities.
Super. Questions? Don't see any gentlemen. Thank you very much. Let's get back to work.
Yeah. What are we working on?
You have to talk to Mr. Saperstein about what you're supposed to do. Is there anybody else who wishes to speak on House Bill 4018A? Seeing none, we'll close public hearing, open a work session. Senator?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4018 as amendment A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Girard has moved House Bill 4018A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Questions on that motion? No discussion. Is there any opposition? There is none. House Bill 4018A moves to the Senate floor with unanimous recommendation, do-pass recommendation, and Senator Bates will carry.
Of course.
We'll close on that. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4058A.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 4058 permits corporations with shares that are registered under the Oregon or federal securities law to reject the vote consent waiver or proxy authorization if a shareholder has not complied with public disclosure requirements of Oregon or federal securities law. It provides that corporations must reject actions of all shareholders not in compliance with disclosure requirements and accept actions when shareholders become compliant. There's no amendment, no fiscal or revenue impact. The House floor vote was 57-2, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you for having me, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Hack, and I represent House District 19, South Salem, Almsville, and Turner. And I'm here today to quickly introduce to you House Bill 4058. This bill permits publicly held corporations to reject the vote, consent, waiver, or proxy authorization of a shareholder if they are not in compliance with the public disclosure requirements under Oregon securities laws as well as federal securities law. House Bill 4058 does come to you with some proposed Dash 2 amendments. One of which speaks to the fact that all will be treated equally, and second stipulates that the shareholder, once they become compliant, will then all privileges prior to will then be restored to them. I've worked closely with small business on this bill, and I believe that it increases transparency for publicly held companies here in Oregon by holding its shareholders accountable to public disclosure requirements. It passed.
Representative,
out of the House.
Did you mention an amendment? We don't have an amendment.
It should already be in it. We did amendments on that.
It is.
So we took care of a couple
don't
of
Don't follow us up on this.
You had us confused here. We didn't have an amendment.
I gave Captain that. And Bill Cross is going to speak to it as well. You might hear a little pushback today in the fact that other states don't have this, but I don't think that that's a good reason to not pass this bill, so it's a good bill, should pass.
Looks like you convinced everybody in the House. Senator Riley.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment. I think the fact that no other states have this may be a good thing for us to do.
Agreed.
We like to be in the cutting edge.
Well, I appreciate that, Senator Riley. And thank you.
Thank you very much, and I have, and I guess I'm going to invite you all up at the same time, Kenny Haglin, is it? John Thomas, and Bill Cross. Two against, and one for. So we'll let you two gentlemen go first, sure. And then Mr. Cross can bat cleanup.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Kenny Haglin. I'm a shareholder at Lane Powell in Portland, Oregon. I'm also the chair of the business law section of the Oregon State Bar. I'm here with John Thomas. He's a partner at Perkins Coie in Portland, and he is the co-chair of our legislative subcommittee. The business law section represents a little under 1,000 business law practitioners in Oregon, and we're here to oppose House Bill 4058. We had a meeting of our executive committee last week. 15 members are on the committee. Not all were present, but we did have a quorum, and the bill was the proposal to oppose the bill was unanimously approved by the committee. John will walk through a few of the rationales that we came up with or some of the reasons why we oppose the bill.
Good afternoon, Chairman Beyer and members of the committee. Again, my name is John Thomas. Before I begin, as I walked into this room, I understood that there's a potential issue that has been raised about my testimony, that my firm may in fact have a conflict of interest involving the proponent of this bill. We did run a quick conflicts check, and according to the results of that check, we do not believe we have any conflicts of interest with the proponent, but I just wanted to get that out there in the open.
Okay. Thank you.
If that matters. So let me begin a little with a background of the federal securities laws requirements for disclosure and the purpose of the purported purpose of this proposal and the problem that it's trying to solve. So under the federal securities laws, shareholders who acquire a certain level of shareholdings in a company, usually it's 5% or 10% depending on the particular section of the securities laws, are required to make public disclosures of those holdings so that both the company and the other shareholders, the public at large, know who the potential control shareholders are in the company, who are the big shareholders who can actually control shareholder action. The problem that this bill purportedly is designed to address is a problem that at any given time, a corporation may not know exactly who those shareholders are, either because the shareholder has just absolutely failed to make those required disclosures, or they haven't made them in a timely fashion, so that at any given point in time, no public company can be absolutely sure of who its shareholders are and who the control shareholders are, so that if it is bringing some proposal before the shareholders, it may not know who has the power to actually control the vote. And this proposal, again, is designed to prevent the company and its management from being blindsided by a control shareholder who hasn't made such disclosures. When the business section of the Oregon State Bar first learned of this just about a couple weeks ago, we were immediately concerned about the interaction of a state law that requires the interpretation of a federal law and the interaction and that on constitutional law questions, laws of federalism, which law would trump what, and how those would be handled. So, for example, again, in federal securities laws, it's the SEC that is the regulatory agency that enforces failure to comply with these disclosure requirements. There is no what's known as a private right of action. No company or individual shareholder can bring an action against a non-compliant shareholder who failed to make the disclosures. Only the SEC can, and they can impose fines and penalties, et cetera. The concern we have is that we would now have management of a particular company making a determination about whether a federal securities law, which is actually fairly complicated, has been complied with. And in doing so, then can completely disenfranchise a shareholder by taking away that shareholder's vote. So we have both constitutional and federalism concerns as well as state remedy law concerns. And again, as the proponent mentioned, this would be we would be the only state in the union that would have this type of provision. That touches on not only legal concerns but also business concerns. When members of our committee canvassed a number of our public company clients to get their reaction to this proposal, first of all, most of them had never heard of this proposal since it's been a recent development, and their immediate reaction was also the same types of concerns we have. They just figured it would result in, if anyone attempted to disenfranchise a voter by rejecting his vote, it would immediately result in all sorts of litigation, both at the state and the federal level. The other concern is that because this is a unique provision that can be viewed as a method of entrenching management. So, in other words, management can decide. It has the power to determine whether or not to reject a vote, and presumably it would not reject a vote if it approved that shareholder's vote. Therefore, the disenfranchising of that vote would constitute an ability of management to remain entrenched and a means to oppress shareholders with which it disagreed. Those are concerns that proxy advisory firms who advise shareholders of our large public corporations generally view with disfavor. And what that means is that oftentimes those proxy advisory firms will recommend withhold votes for directors, and investors themselves, the venture capitalists and the private equity investors who may want to invest in a company, would likely want to avoid any uncertainty associated with this unique corporate law proposal, and would either require as a condition of investment or would urge either reincorporation of an Oregon corporation into another jurisdiction, such as Delaware, or if they're investing in a newly formed entity, require that that entity be formed in another jurisdiction other than Oregon in order to avoid the possibility that at some point down the road it may be completely disenfranchised. There's also So I assume that may have some effect on state revenue, although it sounds like there was a conclusion that wouldn't. The other thing is, as a practical matter, again, if the purpose of the proposal is to reject the vote of a shareholder who hasn't complied with the securities laws, that's the whole problem, is no one will ever know if they've made the necessary public disclosure. So it's hard for us to determine whether this rule even can solve the purported problem that it's designed to address.
So you just said that no one can know if they've filed. How does one know if the filing has been made? Is there some place we can look?
Yes. So schedules, these primarily relate to schedules 13D and G under Section 13 and forms 3, 4, and 5 under Section 16 of the federal securities laws. Those are required to be filed on what's called EDGAR. It's the SEC.gov
right.
site. So those filings are public that you can look them up on the website. But what I'm saying is that the whole problem is that shareholders may not be making those filings, or they may be not timely making those filings. And if they don't do that, those won't show up on the website.
Right.
But there's no way to know. I'm not sure how management can determine whether or not, if they don't even know who the shareholders are, whether there's been an either late filing or a filing at all that should have been made. Do you understand? It's a logical problem.
I understand what you're saying, yes.
Yeah. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
And then finally, the point I'd like to make is that we already have well-established remedies for these types of situations. So Oregon has adopted the Control Share Act. They've adopted the Business Combination Act, which require once shareholders acquire certain levels of shares that a corporation can act to essentially dilute the value of those shares in order to give management enough time to consider an acquisition proposal. And there's also a mechanism known as colloquially as a poison pill. It's a shareholder rights plan, which has also been recognized by state courts as an acceptable means of addressing a potential acquirer who comes in and wants to acquire the company without management's consent or knowledge at the time. And basically what it does is it permits the company to essentially issue a whole bunch more shares so it will dilute the potential control shareholder down to a point where it can't affect an acquisition. So there are other
I need you to wrap it up.
I am almost finished. And so there are already we believe there are already remedies that actually address this problem, and it addresses a problem that this proposal does not solve.
Okay, thank you very much. Bill?
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today on behalf of Willamette Valley Vineyards. We appreciate the support from Representative Jody Hack in bringing this issue to your attention, and we appreciate the support of the House. I think the problem has been outlined quite articulately by the attorneys. And we'd just like to say that some of the defenses that were pointed to are very appropriate for large publicly held corporations. But for small, lightly traded publicly held corporations in Oregon, they're not able to take advantage of some of those defenses, which are fairly expensive to put in place. And you have a lot of stockholders that aren't represented in proxies. They're typically, they own very small shares of the stock. And what we're concerned about is that manipulators and accumulators could acquire enough stock in this kind of lightly traded public company to indeed control the company or affect control over the company. So that's the whole purpose of the bill. And basically it works when Lime Valley Vineyards, for example, has a public, has its annual meeting. It will file with the SEC. The agenda, the issues that are before the board, they will file a record date. So maybe the annual meeting is going to be July 1. They'll file that May 1st is the date of record. So anyone who owns stock as of that date is eligible to participate in the annual business meeting, eligible to participate in votes by proxy or in person or now online, et cetera. That way, if indeed they're not in compliance with the federal disclosure laws, they're not going to be able to participate in that particular meeting. Now, if the, and that's assuming the company adopts this this defense. It's optional. Companies don't have to. But if they do, they would be able to preclude somebody from voting because they weren't of record on the date that it was filed. If indeed that stockholder publicly disclosed, files the appropriate reports, subsequently they would be able to, their voting rights would be restored. So there's a very easy way for them to maintain their voting rights, and that's simply to disclose. Follow the federal law. That's all we're asking.
Okay, question.
Thank you again.
Senator Riley.
Thank you. So does the... Do we know in advance of the vote how many shares they're voting for, how many shares they own, or is this something where we say afterwards, oh, they voted 51% and they haven't shared, so we take that vote away? How would that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, basically if they voted in excess of 5%, they would be out of compliance. So if their shares amounted to 5% of the shares on record, they would be out of compliance.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
So again, we don't know until after they vote how many shares they, if they have more shares than they need to have filed. Is that correct? Otherwise, we'd know how many shares they have, and we would not need to do this.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senator Riley, we would look at the on the date of record. That's when you will have all of your registered stockholders.
The ones who have 5% or more.
If someone has accumulated or acquired, directly or indirectly, above that 5% and wanted to participate in that meeting, they would have to disclose that.
I've got that. Further, please?
Go ahead.
So I got that, but my question is still, at what point do you know that they have more than their 5% if they haven't registered? At what point do you know that they do have? And isn't it after they have tried to vote with more than 5%? Otherwise, if you know beforehand, it doesn't matter. I mean, you know, and that's the point, is to know who has this stock. And if you know before their vote, then you know. And if you wait till after their vote, then you're to find out. And then you have to go back and renew their vote. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, they wouldn't be able to vote. They would not have the ability to vote in that meeting. Now, subsequently, they could if they want to disclose their shares.
How do you know they can't vote if you don't know how many shares they have? I'm very confused about. I mean, I think it's reasonable to require people to follow the law. Okay. I just don't know how you know until they actually file their vote with more than 5%, and then go look and see who's registered. Their 5%. That you would even know that this is the case. That's what bothers me. Does someone else have an answer to that?
No, that's exactly the problem we were identifying.
I had one more comment. One of the things that public companies often do is adopt advance notice bylaws, which limit the proposals that can be brought to the floor on a shareholder meeting, unless the shareholder has been, you know, gives advance notice and gives the board time to think about it and come up with a formulation on how to respond, and so it helps avoid surprises at meetings.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all I have signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who needed to testify? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. Open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4058A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Girod has moved House Bill 4058A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there opposition to the motion? Seeing none, House Bill 4058A moves to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Girod, will you carry?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll close on that. All right, we got those out of the way.
Well, now comes the easy one.
Now we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4036A. No, wait a minute. Did we do this
That's
one?
That's correct. Yeah, we did that one.
We did that one. Right. Yes. My list mixed up here. So we're on.
This is your RPS bill.
This is the
RPS. This is your bill.
This is not my bill. But we have done a little bit. Okay. You want to bring us up to date, Patrick?
Mr. Chair, we heard this bill last week on Wednesday. Since we had the hearing last Wednesday, we have received three amendments: the -A35s. And the -A36 is both from Senator Olson. The A35 deletes the provisions related to transportation and electrification programs. The A36s require electric companies to file forecasts with commission regarding increases in electricity rates related to transportation, electrification, and community solar programs. And then we all have also received the -A41s, which I believe you were going to speak to, Mr. Chair.
Is he going to go over the -A41s as to what they actually do?
I will do them right now. Yes, the chair, I had the -41s addressed or prepared. That was based on lots of the discussion that's been going on here and, frankly, discussion with the Public Utility Commission. There was lots of concerns expressed in the press and everybody else about how this bill got here and what it did and whether the regulator was left out or not. Looking at the bill, the -41s make a number of changes to the bill. And that's the bill that's the amendment that the chair wishes to pursue, but we'll see how that goes today. That amendment retains the goal of 50% renewables by 2040. It retains the goal of moving Oregon ratepayers off of coal by 2030. And I guess I would note on with regard to that, currently if you look at the coal plants, they are pretty much depreciated or on their way to being depreciated. I think that was going anyway. The last Pacific Core plant, I think, hits full depreciation in 2032. So I would suggest to you that the real discussion point for policy is what you do to replace those, whether we're talking about natural gas or renewables. One of the things that was important to me, you know, is, as you all know, I spent 10 years chairing the PUC, or almost 10 years, And I think it's important that we recognize from a policy standpoint that the PUC is a much better position than the legislature is to manage the day-to-day workings of this, and they maintain a good relationship with the utilities they regulate as well as others in the industry. So it's important to me that we put that back in balance, and I think we have in this bill. Other things that we did here that we looked at was we, again, trying to respect ratepayers in that. We opened up the renewable portfolio, or the renewable RECs, renewable energy certificates, so that they were all will all be available. I think the effect of that is some of it with respect to biomass and some of those things that I know many of the counties are interested in. It makes them more likely to be in the game and create jobs in Oregon and create tax benefits in Oregon rather than out of state. We did include the what has been a goal of getting to 8%. We moved that to a mandate that 8% of the portfolio by 2035 would be based on those small generators. In terms of the cost cap, we lowered that from 4% to 3%, although I would note that when we did the original RPS in, I think it was 2007, there was great fears that it would push rates up. To date, that has not been an issue. We have not done that. Hopefully that trend of improved technology will continue. And when you look at these goals, I think it's important to keep in mind that we're not talking about tomorrow. We're talking about something that's 24 years in the future for, is that right? 14 years in the future for the coal issue and 26 years in the future for full compliance. So there's likely to be the same trend continuing of lower, better technology and moving things together. I think that the bill, with the amendments that I'm proposing, creates a better balance while not losing sight of where we're trying to go on renewables. So we'll see. We'll see how the hearing goes. So with that, we'll start back off where we left off last time, and I've invited the chair of the Public Utility Commission, Susan Ackerman, and Jason, if you join her. We'll start back up there. And while they're coming up, I will apologize. There's a lot of people who want to talk. We don't have a lot of time today. We've got to be done roughly by a quarter to three. This room turns into a different committee at 3 o'clock. So we'll do the best we can to hear people. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Susan Ackerman. I am chair of the Public Utility Commission. With me is Jason Eisdorfer, or as I like to say, the fourth commissioner. He is the head of our utility program. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The commission takes no position in support or opposition to this bill. But before I begin, I wanted to address two claims that are circulating in Salem about the PUC. The first is that Governor Brown has muzzled the PUC. That is simply not the case. The governor and the PUC had some communication miscues, to be sure, early in this process, but that is in the past. Not once has the governor asked us not to communicate with the legislature about this bill. The second claim is that the PUC's concerns about the bill stem from the fact that we were left out of the negotiation process or because we are against action to reduce carbon emissions, and that is also not the case. The PUC is a very mission-directed agency. Our charge is to protect Oregon customers. We view the bill from the standpoint of how the specific provisions in the bill will affect Oregon consumers. From that standpoint, and that standpoint only, we are concerned about the negative impacts that some of the bill provisions could have on Oregon consumers. Here are two of our concerns. We believe that the provision to ban the import of coal-generated electricity into Oregon starting in 2030 will be both costly and ineffectual. It will raise customer rates, but it will not actually reduce the amount of carbon emitted from those plants into the air as compared to a future without that provision. We don't have an estimate of the rate impact of this provision, but it could be hefty. We have requested an analysis by Pacific of the rate impact post-2030, but have not received that yet. This provision will help Oregon meet its greenhouse gas goals simply because of how we account for greenhouse gas emissions in the state of Oregon. It's an accounting scheme. But this provision won't change what coal plants actually operate or how they operate, and therefore it won't reduce actual emissions. At our public meeting on this bill, the utilities acknowledged that this specific provision will not force coal plants to close or change how they operate. With regard to the increased RPS requirement, the current provisions to ensure reliable power now and in the future don't go far enough, in our opinion. Both the National Reliability Organization, which you know is the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, or NERC, and the Western Reliability Organization, or WEC, have recently identified the growth in variable wind and solar generation as one of the key challenges to our power grid. These challenges are not insurmountable, but they must be addressed. We cannot compromise reliability. We appreciate the provisions in the bill that address reliability. We believe, however, that the current language is too limiting to evaluate threats to reliability if such threats occur. For example, the provision should be broader so that it could address potential impacts on balancing areas other than PGE and PacifiCorp. PGE's and PacifiCorp's systems are interconnected with and affect systems of other utilities that serve other Oregon customers, such as BPA or Idaho Power. The bill currently includes no provisions to account for that. We also believe that we must be proactive in developing complementary strategies to incorporate this unprecedented level of renewables into our grid reliably and at a reasonable cost. We've had a chance to review the Dash 41 amendments, Chair Beyer, and believe they are good amendments, and we thank you very much for offering those. They address many of our concerns, the Dash 41 amendments do. And Jason is going to go over this in detail when I'm done, but I wanted to end with a few observations. The first is that the Commission has long been concerned about carbon emissions, and we currently use our regulatory process to influence how PacifiCorp and PGE manage their coal fleets. We've rejected proposals to build new coal plants when we deemed those proposals did not affect Oregon customers. We approved the closure or conversion of a number of coal plants like PGE's Boardman plant or PacifiCorp's Carbon plant. We rejected expensive pollution control upgrades proposed for coal plants. We require annual ongoing analysis of whether some plants should be shut down as an alternative to expensive pollution controls. In short, we made resource decisions that would actually result in carbon emissions reductions and not simply wall off coal electrons. Second, the policies embedded in the bill are not ones the Commission would have preferred. We believe that there are policies that are more effective for the environment and more effective for consumers. In fact, one concern is that taking this path will preclude further action to address carbon emissions in an efficient and effective way. Third, though, if the bill passes in whatever form, we will implement it to the best of our ability with an eye towards protecting consumers, which is our mission. Again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. I can answer questions now, or we can take questions after Jason's presentation.
Let's let Jason go ahead.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Jason Eisdorfer, Program Director of the Public Utility Commission. It's good to see you again. I just wanted to highlight four parts of the amendments that go toward a long way toward addressing some of the concerns that Chair Ackerman raised. And we attempted to deliver in writing some of these ideas to the key bill proponents several weeks ago. And so we very much appreciate the fact that they found their way into these amendments. The first one is Section 2 on page 3 of the Dash 41s. This amendment clarifies that the Commission can exclude from rates going forward any utility investments in coal plants that will bring value to the plants past the year 2030. So if Oregon customers are basically cutting the cord with these coal plants and not getting any benefits from them after 2030, these customers shouldn't be paying for additional investments in these coal plants whose lifetimes extend past 2030. So we just wanted to make that clear. Second, the amendments put reliability first. The amendment language says that the Commission or a utility can ask for an investigation to determine if the levels of renewables on the system creates a reliability problem. If the Commission determines that it does, the PUC can temporarily exempt the utility from the RPS obligations until reliability concerns are alleviated. That is Section 13. Third, we had a concern that language in the electric vehicle section directed the Commission when determining what goes into electric customer rates to include considerations of job growth and economic development in the transportation sector, among other considerations. The amended language allows the PUC to consider the various values of electric vehicles, but does not statutorily tie electricity rates with job growth in the transportation sector. That is Section 20. And finally, the amendments wrap all of the various regulatory studies and do-overs that was from the underlying bill into a single directive to the commission to study the impacts of the new RPS standard and report back to you in the year 2020, along with any recommendations for additional legislation. That's Section 27. There are additional elements to the amendments, but at this time we're not making comments on those. So those are the four pieces that we've been, some of the issues that we've had for quite some time, and finally I think these amendments help address them.
So, Commissioner, with
Chair
the Dash 41s, are many, most, some of your concerns taken care of?
Most of them, Chair Beyer. We obviously, as we indicated in the testimony, we think there are better ways to decarbonize the power sector, and that's better for consumers. But your Dash 41 amendments have smoothed some of the rougher edges for us, and so we support the amendments and thank you for them.
Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you mentioned the fact that this does not do anything to change the operation of the coal plants, and I'm wondering if I understand that that may be true if we're the only state that does this, but we may just be the first state that does this. And if other states join us in that, won't that have the effect of reducing the coal plants that actually produce power?
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, yes, it may. But, you know, these coal plants are located in Montana and Wyoming and Utah, and these are coal-producing states. Mm-hmm. And it is unlikely, in my opinion, that those coal-producing states are going to take action like this to shut down those coal plants.
Yep. Senator Girard?
Yeah, there's an axiom around the building, and I always love it in cases like this. If you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And I kind of think that applies to the ratepayer, and I applaud the Dash 41s. I think that helps quite a bit. But the obligation to reduce carbon, it seems to me like we're obligated, and I think the PUC would agree with this, to try to do it in the most cost-efficient manner possible so that the ratepayer doesn't get hit with a lot of bills. And so my question to you is, I believe we have to reduce carbon. I'm not one of those that's stuck that we're not. But if we do, it just seems to me like there's other more efficient ways to do it. Can you? Is there anything that the PUC can say that you see ways to reduce carbon that would be cheaper for the ratepayer?
It's the staff saying, no, I'm not getting into that.
Responsibility. Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, thank you for the question. The answer to that is yes. Mm-hmm. We have long considered a carbon tax or a cap and trade policy to be a more effective way to limit carbon emissions, but we know that those are unpopular.
I did ask.
Senator, we happen to have a bill that addresses one of those.
Great question, Senator.
Thank you.
We need him removed from the diet.
Senator?
Thank you, Chair Mayor. A couple of questions. One of the concerns expressed by the PUC has been the cost of this. And
I wasn't expecting that.
The investor-owned utilities analysis, to me, it appears to be somewhat rudimentary in that it suggests about a 1% increase per year. It doesn't seem to address the phasing out of the taxpayer-subsidized parts of this of the RPS. And it doesn't address anything after 2030. And it seems to me that the most onerous parts of this bill, from the standpoint of the ratepayer, kick in at about 2030. So has the PUC, do you have figures that show what you believe the cost will be over the next, to 2030 and then 2030 and beyond?
Chair Byers, Senator Bassett,
we don't have figures that we can definitively tell you what's going to happen. One of the problems here, of course, is that this is there's two chunks of the two major chunks of the bill, the RPS and the coal phase out. And there are cost implications to both of those, and they happen at different times, and the RPS is staged in, and they're 15 and 20 years away. And so it's very difficult to be able to come out and say, here's what the rate impacts are. I will say that the PacifiCorp analysis did end in 2030, which is when the coal phase-out kicks in. It is at that point that the output of those coal plants would have continued to come to serve Oregon ratepayers. So by not analyzing the cost impacts there, I think there's a gap. In addition, the PGE analysis tends to show there's not a whole lot of difference on the RPS side between now and 2030. And in fact, given the existing RPS, there's not a significant jump between now and 2025 anyway. And so I think their analysis would show costs beginning more significant costs beginning in 2030, but their analysis did go to 2040. So a lot of these cost implications are kicked out further, and at that point you're really working on a series of assumptions that we can all disagree on, and it's sort of hard to tell you exactly what the rate impact might be.
Go ahead.
Follow up. A different question. Are you able to cite any precedent for the requirement for the PUC to permit investor-owned utilities to invest in the construction, installation of, and management of, and operation of electric vehicle stations in Oregon, and to recover those costs from their ratepayers?
Senator Whitsitt. California has decided to allow that, is my understanding, that they have decided that the market for electric vehicles needs the utilities to participate to jumpstart it. And so my understanding is, yes, that's happening in California.
Has the PUC ever done anything like that in Oregon before?
No.
Thank you. And one final question. There are passages in this bill that speak to rate setting regarding social and environmental benefits. Do you have some methodology how you would decide what the social and environmental benefits are worth?
Senator Whitsitt, in our integrated resource planning now, we take into account potential future costs of carbon. So we do have a way of addressing carbon costs, because we believe that carbon costs that arise in the future will affect consumers. So that's within our scope, is to protect consumers, and that's how we consider that. Social costs we don't consider. I'm aware that the United States Department of Energy has developed something called social cost of carbon, and some states are using that. We have liked, as a utility commission, to distinguish between what affects the power system specifically, and that's something that's fair for the consumer to pay for, versus what is some other goal that, like jobs or the economy or something like that, and that should be paid for not by consumers of the electric services, but by the legislature, basically.
Thank you.
Sarah.
Thank you, Chair Byer. Thank you for allowing me to be here.
A guest today.
Yeah. So it's no surprise that I fully agree with your notion that ultimately we have to move to carbon pricing or a cap and trade program. And I thank Senator Girard for leading you to that response. But I'm just, I'm wondering, following up on Senator Whitsitt's question about the cost to ratepayers and projections of the cost to ratepayers. If we did move to a system in which carbon was there was a price put on carbon, what effect would that have if these two programs were both to be adopted by the state? Do you see, first of all, a way for the two to be able to work conjointly, and then how that may have an effect on perhaps, mitigating the cost strictly due to this program.
Chair Byers, Senator Dembro, I think they could work together. Our concern has been that if you take a policy that is this huge, it'll be years before we can get to another policy that would actually maybe do this in a better way. My concern is that the cap and trade or carbon tax program would be more effective at reducing carbon in the least cost fashion, let me put it that way, rather than a technology mandate. And I'm going to let Jason jump in here because he probably has more important things to say.
Chair Byer, Senator Dembro, not more important, a similar kind of concept, which is the concept of the price on carbon really tries to drive down to the most effective and least cost carbon reduction technique. And so, for example, I think you probably have to have both an RPS and a cost of carbon, but the price on carbon actually hooks the transportation sector and the electric sector together in ways that this sort of, it's sort of ham-fisted, the EV provision in this bill is something that we'll implement and we'll do, but it's not sort of the natural economic, it's not the obvious economic solution from this bill where it is with a cost of price of carbon, for example. So, I mean, I think in some ways you do both. Commissioner Ackerman's point is staging it both from a price point and, frankly, from a political point of view, I think is important.
Senator Ryan? Yeah, I just want to kind of go back to the thought that Boardman is the only plant that we have currently that burns coal, and that's scheduled to go off in the near future.
2020.
So the state really has no coal manufacturers as far as energy production. And so when you plug into the grid, there's nothing that says the electron that you got is from coal. So I'm trying to understand the advantage of trying to tell Wyoming what to do with their coal and their grid when there's no differential in the electron as to where it came from. Does that make sense, or am I?
Your question makes sense to me, Chair Byer, Vice Chair Girard. Yes, the physics of the electric system means that if the plant is running, the electrons are on the grid, and you can't actually put up a wall at the border and keep those electrons out. There is, of course, which has been stayed by the Supreme Court right now, but the EPA's Clean Power Plan, which would affect coal plants in the future. And so that was why I was trying to make a distinction between what will happen to those coal plants under this bill versus what would happen to those coal plants in the absence of the bill. In the absence of the bill, the Clean Power Plan will hopefully at some point get actually implemented, and it will influence those plants.
Just one last follow-up. To redeem myself with my colleagues on this thing, what I was trying to get at is there's other technologies out there like hydrogen technology, which may be getting to our grid in the near future, that does not produce any carbon and would actually even out the system. So have you been involved at all in hydrogen technology, or am I talking Greek here?
Chair Byer, Senator Girard, no, you are not talking Greek. We are technology agnostic at the PUC. We don't get involved in actually advocating for specific technologies. In fact, one of our concerns here is that this mandates a certain technologies, and we think there would be, better ways to do that. There is a question out there. I know that the International Panel on Climate Change believes that deep decarbonization will only happen with nuclear power and traditional thermal generation with carbon capture and sequestration. I believe that our U.S. Department of Energy actually funds research into those two technologies, and I think that's fair because I'm not sure we can deeply decarbonize the power sector without relying on big iron like that. So I'm going to stop, and I'm going to let Jason clean up for me.
We do have this little constitutional problem on the West Coast.
I am aware of the constitutional problem, but excuse me, Senator Beyer, I'm aware of the constitutional problem.
Can I add just a comment?
You sure can.
Well, you have to, I mean, with all the renewables, you have to have something. You hit the switch and you have power. I mean, so you're either looking at gas burning or that's why I think hydrogen is just such a nice thing. I mean, it makes hydro really very efficient. And that would have a lot of that should be a focus that we have here in the Northwest, where we do have a fair amount of hydro. So that's the reason I thought for sure you would definitely say hydro, and I wasn't expecting cap and trade.
Senator, I would note for you that current law included, incorporating this, as hydrogen as a renewable resource, qualifying under the RPS.
There are
so your issues have been taken care of.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, there are some public generators that have their own hydro systems in the Northwest, and I understand that some of their big loads are leaving the region, and there will be available surplus hydropower from those non-BPA hydro generation. So that is an available option, probably for purchase for Oregon.
And in fact, new ones, irrigation-based or small hydro, does meet the RPS.
Yeah, but nothing prior
yes,
to
sir.
93.
Mm-hmm. Senator.
Thank you. Just one final question. That going back to the social environmental part of it, and I'm not sure that exactly fits, but notwithstanding the thousands of bald eagles and golden eagles that these windmills kill every year, I was looking at the decommissioning costs. I mean, when these windmills and the solar panels or solar farms and so forth are depreciated out, or they're replaced by something a better technology. What happens to them? Are they considered as a stranded cost to be paid for by the ratepayer to dismantle them and take them away, or is there some sort of a bonding requirement before you put them in to make sure that there's money to do that, or would you just leave them there?
Chair Beyer, Senator Whitsitt, when the Utility Commission establishes prices for its electric utilities and the supplies are built, the cost of the supplies are built into rates, usually we depreciate the full cost of the resource before it's taken out of service, which is what's happening right now, as Senator Chair Beyer indicated, with some of PacifiCorp's coal plants. They're fully depreciated. So that would be the case with wind and solar as well. And to the extent there are cleanup aspects of end of life for these resources, they would be treated the same way a natural gas or a coal plant would be treated. In other words, the cost would be built into rates and consumers would pay for that.
Thank you.
But that's the same with all resources.
That's what I said. At least I thought that was what I said.
I actually have to, my wife and I were on the Big Island in Hawaii, and they have a rather large wind farm there. That they're not operating anymore. So you have just this boneyard of windmills, and they're still burning carbon, if you will, because it's just it got cost prohibitive. I think what the good senator is asking, when the technology is such, who's going to remove those windmills so we don't have a boneyard that's going to be rather sizable in eastern Oregon? Because I think technology is changing rapidly.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, that is so far in the future, I actually have not considered what will happen to these resources. I'm assuming that, like perhaps the Trojan plant, when it was shut down and decommissioned, ultimately it was broken up and carried away. And I think the same thing would be true for these plants as well.
And just to make the point,
go ahead.
My understanding, those windmills have quite a significant footprint in that they have to have an attachment to the ground and under the ground sufficient to counteract the massive torque of those great big blades. And so it's not just a matter of taking the windmill down. It's also a massive, there's a lot of concrete and steel and so forth underground. It would be a major undertaking. And I have no idea what that would cost per windmill, but I'm guessing it would be substantial.
More? Thank you very much. You've been heard.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Beyer.
Let's see here. Mr. Jenks. Citizens Utility Board is the other one that has a statutory provision to represent ratepayers.
Thank you, Chairman Byers, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jenks. I'm the executive director of the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. CUB is set up under Oregon law to represent the interests of residential customers of investor-owned utilities. We're supportive of this bill. We see coal as the single biggest financial risk that utility customers are taking right now, and we can see that today. There's been talk at this hearing about carbon taxes and carbon tax cap and trade. PacifiCorp is a utility with over 60% of its power supply in coal. If we put if we put prices on carbon, their rates go up. And my concern as a ratepayer advocate is protecting those customers. And in the long term, we know there's going to be costs associated with carbon regulation, whether that be state-based, federal-based, or where it is. And the best way we can do to protect customers from those high costs is to start to phase out coal plants. And what the idea of this bill is to phase them out over a period of time from Oregon, so we have time through the integrated resource planning process to make sure that we're replacing them in the least cost manner possible, so that there's a lot of time to manage this transition. But we need to manage this transition, or customers are going to get hit with significant costs associated with these plants. I went back and looked at the utility integrated resource plans. The current coal fleet that serves Oregon, if we want to maintain that coal fleet past 2030, we would have to invest more than $2 billion in retrofits onto those coal plants. Coal plants aren't cheap. The era of cheap coal is over. Coal plants are getting increasingly expensive. That's why we're closing Boardman. That's why we've seen some other plants close. And we're going to see a lot of the plants that serve Oregon now close because they're going to require significant investment. With this bill, we're saying Oregon customers are not going to continue to invest in coal. That's not a good investment. That's not where we will get value over the long term. That's a financial risk. And rather than spending billions of dollars increasing or continuing our financial risk in coal, we believe it's better to start to redirect ratepayers' money to renewable resources, to natural gas turbines to help shape and balance those things, and to resources that are cleaner and will create less of that coal and carbon risk. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Questions?
Senator? Just one question. Mr. Jenks, would you agree that the financial risk and the cost of carbon dioxide emissions is established by government regulation and without exception, actually, and that largely that is been created through the EPA's Clean Power Plan that had just been trashed by the Supreme Court?
The risk is, I believe, that's one risk is the Clean Power Plan. I mean, the risk here of a carbon tax being passed in Oregon would be another risk, the regional haze risk of the need to clean up these power plants, not because of carbon, but because of SOx and NOx, SO2 and nitrogen oxides, which is what Boardman was affected by. That's a big risk, and those laws contain. So there's several things. There's a coal ash cost that are coming up. Just the coal mines themselves, a lot of these plants that serve Oregon aren't competitively fueled. They're fueled by specific captive mines right there, and we're seeing extraordinary increases in the cost of coal mines. So there's a whole series of things that are putting upward pressure and financial risk on coal. One of them is the Clean Power Plan, but there's a lot of other things that could push those prices up and seemingly are doing that right now.
I'm not sure that you answered the question. The question was, all this is established by government regulation, all this requirement.
Yes. They're not just simply carbon, but environmental regulations on coal plants will almost always come from government.
Senator?
Actually, I agree with quite a bit of what you're saying, but I do have a little bit about the footprint that we're leaving by the renewables, mm-hmm. Specifically the impact of the sage-grouse on windmills, and then solar, the amount of solar, the power that we get per acre, and the acre that has to be devoted to solar, that seems like a huge footprint to me as well. And so I agree that coal is going to be phased out, but it seems like putting all our apples and oranges into windmills and solar probably isn't a good idea either.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, first, I don't disagree with what you're saying, and again, I think the bill isn't trying to say it's all wind and solar. We may well have additional geothermal. We may have biomass. We may well have wave and other renewable technologies. I don't know what renewable technologies will develop over the 25 years we're dealing with in this life, so I don't want to predict any particular technologies, but there are siting issues. I'm not an expert on land use. I'm an economist that deals with energy issues. So I know there's going to be siting issues, but I know that there's folks who in Eastern Oregon who would like to see the economic development associated with this. And so I assume those sorts of things can be worked out and will be worked out, because when there's economic opportunities in Oregon, we tend to be able to figure ways to do it. So but I do recognize there will be siting issues when you're trying to sort of build large facilities. There are when you're trying to build natural gas or coal facilities also.
Just one other question.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Jenks. Has the Citizens Utility Board independently created any analysis, any economic analysis of what this bill passing would cost the ratepayers that you are protecting?
I worked with Renewable Northwest. They hired an outside consultant who's worked for Bonneville and some folks to do that. I worked with him to help set the parameters and define that study and was an advisor to him on that study. And I believe that study shows that depending on what you do, what assumptions you make about continuing the production tax credit, and what assumptions you make about future carbon regulation, it would show anything from a price decrease of about 4% to a price increase of 0.9%. And I'm happy to share that. I've shared that with some folks in the House. I'm happy to share that with folks here.
I'd very much like to see that.
Okay.
I'd like to know what assumptions you made.
Senator Thompson?
Is that per year?
That's an increase over what would happen otherwise. So in any one year, it could be that high or that low. But what it's saying is you project what business as usual, what costs would be without this bill, and then you're saying in any one year, costs would be anywhere from 4% lower to 0.9% higher in the analysis that was done.
So that was per year.
Yes, it's per year, but it's per year for both lines. So it's not compounding that much. It's because both lines are going up over time, or both lines. It's a difference between the two different lines of business as usual versus the law.
Others?
That's interesting. Just to comment, 4% per year decrease by 2030, we would be our power rates would be reduced by 60%.
Again, it's not a 4% discrete. It means 4% lower than they would be under the business as usual case. So I'm not trying to say there's a cumulative addition or subtraction. What I'm trying to say is the range of rates compared to what they would be without the bill will be within a range of about 5%, some below 4%. Below to 1% above, so it's going to be in that range each year over the time period of the law.
I guess part of the test on that is if you looked at the concerns in 2007 when the RPS was first instituted, right. There was fears that it would go too high, which is why the cost cap was put in at 4%, and I don't believe we've ever hit that.
Right, we have not hit the cost cap of 4% to this date. So,
and at least the amendment reduces that cost cap by a percent. Other questions, Bob?
Just for the sake of argument, most of the cost of the RPS was borne by the taxpayer, not the ratepayer.
Different issue, Senator.
that
actually applies to the whole range, whether you're talking about coal or whatever you're talking about. The wonders of the tax system. More? Thank you, Bob.
Great, thank you.
Let's see. Now we're going to get into some people who I wanted to make sure I have two county commissioners here who've driven a long way. Commissioner Lycan and Commissioner Kramer, would you like to come up? And Mary as well. I guess you're with them. I have four?
We have another commissioner.
Oh, okay. Well, come on up then. I only had three on the list.
Jeez.
Sorry, I listed myself as an irrigation district manager. It's my other job.
Oh, all right.
That's what I was.
Whoever wants to go.
Okay. Excuse me. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, committee members. My name is Steve Kramer, Wasco County Commissioner. And thank you for the opportunity today to testify in support of House Bill 4036 with the A41 amendments. I appreciate the changes in Section 14 that the amendment makes, particularly the 8% goal requirement. requiring smaller-scale community-based renewable energy projects in Oregon support rural communities with jobs and construction and for operations with the increased tax revenues, both income and property.
Oh, Hood River.
Wasco County, we would like to have the same opportunities as our surrounding communities have had in developing these small-scale community-based projects. We have witnessed the positive economic that these projects have made, especially in Hood River County, and we would like to take advantage of some of these opportunities as well. One example that I can cite today is one of our local irrigation districts is piping our main line for better delivery and conservation. This amendment would encourage local support. Water would be saved, energy be created, the resources would be received for investment back into the system. So today I thank you for your work in developing the A41 amendments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Les Perkins. I'm a manager of Farmers Irrigation District in Hood River County. I've also been a Hood River County Commissioner for 15 years, focusing mostly on water, energy, and natural resource issues. I want to thank you for allowing me to speak today on in support of House Bill 4036, particularly the Dash 41 amendments. Again, like Commissioner Kramer, I'm interested in the 8% carve-out for community renewables. Farmers Irrigation District delivers water to about 6,000 acres of high-value farmland. What most people don't know is we have a couple of low-impact hydro-certified facilities within our district. And those two plants generate, well, they have a nameplate capacity of about 4.4 megawatts. We generate about 26 million kilowatt hours per year. And over the 30 years those plants have been operating, we've generated over $45 million in revenue. And that revenue has all gone 100% back into our community in the form of infrastructure and jobs. What that has done for our district is that over the 30 years, we've reduced our requirement, the amount of water that it takes to deliver water to our farmers. So we now take about half as much water out of the river to serve the same number of acres as we did 30 years ago. And at the same time, we've also reduced our energy consumption. So as Commissioner Kramer said, this is a tremendous opportunity for rural communities in particular and agricultural-based communities. These projects allow infrastructure upgrades and investment in the communities that we really have no other way to fund. So I would like to thank you for listening to me and just understand that the 8% carve-out is tremendously important for projects like ours. Without that carve-out and that mandate, projects like ours are unlikely to be built in the future. Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Sid Lycan. I'm in my second term as Lane County Commissioner. And prior to that, I served 10 years as Springfield's mayor. And so thank you for allowing me to speak. I don't want to duplicate too much here because I think my fellow commissioners really, I think, kind of hit on the issue of what this will do for rural Oregon. I will say, though, that I think part of this is by requiring smaller scale projects in Oregon really does add an economic dimension that supports communities with jobs during construction and operation. Remember, this is potential increased tax revenue, both property and income. So I think this is real opportunity. I will touch on this, and I think this is key when it comes to Lane County and some of our other surrounding counties, is that in supporting the A41 amendments, this, and so, Mr. Chair, I want to say thank you very much for adding this. I think this is really key. So supporting A41 amendments, this is also the inclusion of biomass and biomass projects in Section 14 of the amendments. So Lane and several other surrounding counties are covered in a large swath of forest land that could provide a resource to biomass plants, generating both electricity and heat. And I've had the opportunity, or maybe someone may disagree with that. Sometimes I disagree with this, but as having a front row seat as far as regarding the issue of developing a comprehensive forest management plan out of Washington, D.C., and it can kind of give you a headache. But Lane County strongly supported the plan put forth by Congressman DeFazio, Walden, and Schrader. And then I worked very closely with Senator Wyden, and while we were close, it wasn't there. It wasn't quite there. But I think both Senator Wyden and Congressman DeFazio have actually been on record to support
biomass as an opportunity, as an alternative. And so this is something I think that we want to continue to move forward on. And I think this will benefit many, not just Lane County, but many rural counties around the state of Oregon. So again, I want to say thank you for the opportunity to speak. And Mr. Chair, thank you for developing the A41 amendments, which we strongly support, not only Lane County, but on behalf of the Associate of Oregon Counties. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions?
Is for Commissioner Like, and I represent Timber Country,
yes,
as
you do.
Well know, and I'm sure you're very aware that it depends on the calculations. We're either number one or number two forest fires, and if you really, truly wanted to reduce carbon, I think anybody that's prudent about carbon needs to be willing to allow the harvest of timber to make fire breaks to reduce the risk of fire. I'm pretty sure you would concur with that.
Well, I not only have had the opportunity to represent Lane County, but I grew up in Douglas County, and my family's been in the wood products industry beginning back in about 1900. And so this is very important, and you're exactly right. I don't think we're talking about 1.4 billion board feet that was harvested off ONC lands when Congressman Weaver was in Congress, but we're talking about something that's less than half. And really, I think that the plan in place would be very helpful. I don't think any of us want to go through the issue of the forest fires that happened here in the state of Oregon, really in the last 3 years. They were significant, and it's cost the state a tremendous amount of money, and but it's cost communities. And I think our Eastern Oregon colleagues can tell you what's happening in the east side. So thank you for the question.
Different issue.
I understand.
It's not a different issue. It's about carbon reduction, and I think that's a very viable issue. Just can I make one? If for you that don't know, mass is equal. That's basic physics. So you burn up a tree or you kill a tree, that all goes up into carbon dioxide. So that's a huge carbon emitter. And like I said, we need to reduce carbon in the most cost-efficient manner that we have in this state. And we don't want to touch that. And I think that's just plain wrong.
And that's one of the reasons biomass is included in the bill.
Well, but biomass is a very small part of it.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much,
thank
you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
All righty, let's see. I'm running out of time. I need to get the utilities up here. Mr. Robertson and Mr. Bolton.
Thank you, Mr. Gentlemen. Chairman. Good afternoon. Committee members, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Power. Just a few quick thoughts, because I know we don't have a lot of time today. First, I want to thank and commend you, Mr. Chairman, for continuing this conversation forward. I think certainly at this stage of the session, there's been a considerable amount of input into this legislation. There's certainly been quite a bit of refinement that's been put on the table since it was initially conceived, and we think it's a conversation that needs to continue going forward. The reason for which I think most folks are familiar with is one of the motivations for moving forward on this bill is certainly to avoid what we believe would be more adverse ballot measures. But also I would say that as we have looked, and Pacific Corp in particular is a regional utility that has retail businesses in six other states and certainly interconnect with 10 or 11 other states, depending on how you look at our transmission system. You know, we're a keen follower of regional carbon and environmental policy. And as we look at state-based climate policy solutions, we believe that this policy is actually the most cost-effective path forward as far as what a state can do to lower actual net greenhouse gas emissions and do so more cost-effectively than a state implementing a cap and trade or a carbon tax. We are in some disagreement on
disagree with the commissioner.
Well, we try to limit that whenever we can, but certainly when we look at what a state can do to reduce emissions, a cap and trade system that does not encompass the power plants that generate carbon dioxide emissions and certainly a carbon tax that is placed on the retail consumer are both very expensive policies, potentially, depending on what that carbon price is set at, and do not result in emissions reduction. In fact, it's the same effect as what was described with the commission's presentation, that you're not actually changing the operations of a coal or fossil fuel plant. We do believe, and we have presented to other legislative committees and to the commission itself, our analysis that the increase in renewable generation that would result from this legislation does result in a net reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, because we're adding to that renewable resource generation base, and intuitively that will always be your first dispatched resource. So the more energy you're able to get out of non-fuel renewable resources, the less you have to rely on fossil fuel resources. That's good for the environment because it reduces emissions. It's also good for the consumer when we make sure that we have a cost-effective investment in the first place in that resource, because we're avoiding future fuel costs and certainly additional regulatory and, frankly, political risks. I think the Dash 41 amendment is something that makes some improvements as far as ensuring that there is a balanced outcome to this this policy discussion. We encourage that discussion, and I'm happy to leave off there and answer any questions if you have any. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thanks. Members of the committee, Dave Robertson for the record, Portland General Electric. I appreciate the chair moving forward with the Dash A41s. We want to keep the process moving. I think we would have some concerns about them, but I can address those as questions come along. I think a couple of topics that have come up that are important to understand is that as we've done the analysis on the bill and the renewables portions of the bill, we do get Portland General Electric to meeting the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals by the year 2050, or at least on trajectory to get there by the year 2040. And so for us, it is a fairly cost-effective approach. Throughout the years between now and 2040, we're going to need to replace resources that we're going to lose anyway. We're going to lose the Boardman plant in 2020. We've got contracts for hydropower from the Mid-Columbia dams that expire into the late 2020s and 2030s. We're going to need to replace those. Whatever happens with the coal strip plant, we may need to replace that at some point. So we've got contracts with the plant up in Centralia, the coal plant that will expire. We need to replace those. What this will say is, as we replace those resources, we will do it mostly with renewables and possibly natural gas to back that up. And so we're looking at that. We'll look at all of those choices as we look and work through the PUC's integrated resource plan. Our concerns, as you look at a carbon tax, is that to get to the reductions that would be required and the cost of a carbon tax to get to those reductions, even the Portland State University study says that at $150 a ton, you only get to 35% of reduction below 1990 levels. The state goal in 2050 is 75% below. So this bill gets you significantly on track. And I can say, just for the sake of benchmarking, about we looked at the California price on carbon that's down in their market right now, which is about $11 a ton. And for us, more or less, for us, if you assume that were the number, that's about a 5% rate impact on our customers just for that. And my concern with that, and I think everyone should be concerned about impacts to consumers, is what do you get for that money? Do you get carbon reductions, or are you just paying a tax from our customers? So this gets you something. There's a real reductions, a reasonable place with modest rate impacts, and this is why we think this approach is most workable. Thank you.
I guess I would pose one question to both of you. I mean, sure. There's the argument that rather than this, we should be looking at hydro. Can you talk about the reality of that?
Hydrogen.
Sure.
Hydrogen or hydro?
We can talk about both.
Based on hydro.
Well, Chair Beyer, committee members, certainly hydrogen as a future technology holds a lot of promise. I think there's already some policy in place to encourage hydrogen solutions. One of the features of this bill is to look into and incorporate into the standard here energy storage, which I think hydrogen can play a role in. Certainly hydro, if they were making more, we'd be buying more. There's just not a lot of opportunities around hydro. Certainly where there have been the ability to invest in efficiency upgrades to existing plants to get more power generation. We have made those investments where they've made sense. Those do count towards the RPS, and we think that that's a really great feature of Oregon's renewable standard. And certainly, if we ever had the opportunity to be endowed with the ability to directly purchase from the federal Columbia River power system, that would be great. But that's probably a much bigger conversation and much more controversial than what we're talking about today.
Yeah, I don't think the public should go in there, but go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on the hydropower, you know, PGE is about 25% hydropower. I think, as Scott says, we've done a number of hydro upgrades, small hydro counts toward the RPS, and we've had some projects like that. We can actually count 50 average megawatts of certified low-impact hydro toward the RPS, and hydropower output from our Pelton Round Butte project on the Deschutes counts, at least 50 average megawatts of that. So that was very important in the 2007 bill. We actually do integrate some renewables with our hydropower that we've got, but that's limited since we're only 25% hydro. So the more hydro we can get, we love hydro, the more we can get, the more we'll actually would be great. We got to analyze that, of course, at the commission to make sure it's least cost and lowest risk to do that. But we heart hydro. Put that on the record for PGE. The other thing for hydrogen, just for full disclosure, my uncle is the head of a business venture called Hydrogen Hubs. Jack Robertson is his name, former BPA deputy administrator. I've heard a lot about hydrogen hubs at Thanksgiving dinners over the years from Uncle Jack. And I can tell you that I think his biggest challenge is the cost of, and he's really promoting the use of large sort of converted diesel-type engines to run off of ammonia, which is a form of hydrogen. And that ammonia would be made at night with wind power or hydropower, excess hydropower from the dams. I think the biggest challenge is how much energy it costs to create that ammonia versus how the cost of natural gas or other power in the market. And I think that's the biggest challenge he's faced. And I think their first market they're trying to penetrate is California. So I can say that is something we'll look at into the future and we'll analyze as a renewable resource as part of any future renewable portfolio standard. But that's kind of what I know about hydrogen, Mr.
Chair. Both of your companies have looked at it.
Yes, we have.
In the past. It just hadn't penciled.
Right.
Thank you, Mr.
Coleman. You.
The Oregon emissions per capita are already well below those in Utah and Wyoming, Montana, your Rocky Mountain states that you provide the services to. So those red states. So is your company promoting a doubling of the renewable portfolio standard in those states, in Wyoming, Montana, and Utah?
Chair Beyer, Senator Whitsitt, no. We're not. We don't have ballot measures that would require the same framework that we've frankly accepted here. But I would also say that we have an entirely different level of regulatory and political risk in those states around those resources where they do have industries and jobs that are based on that resource. So it frankly, for us, it's as much a risk management exercise to try to hold costs down and have some stability in how we plan our business.
And another question, please. So thank you for either one of you. We talked earlier about the decommissioning cost of solar farms and windmills and the interconnection of all that. Do you have a plan? Will you be charging your ratepayers for the decommissioning? I mean, some of those will be depreciated out. Some of them, if the hydrogen comes in, they may become obsolete in 3 to 5 to 10 years, whatever. You know. So when they become either obsolete or depreciated, how will you handle? Will you leave them there like they've done in Hawaii, or will you take them out, and who will pay for it?
Senator Whitsitt, it's a great question because we are talking about expanding our reliance on renewable energy, and we should have plans and we should reassure the public how those sites will be taken care of. And just like any power plant that we own and operate, we do include the costs of decommissioning or a kind of terminal sense with those resources. What I would say is that with renewable resources, and of course we don't have the same decades of experience with those as we do with other power plant technologies, but as you look at it, the real value to those resources aren't necessarily the turbines or the panels, it's the site itself. It's somewhere that's sunny or it's somewhere that's windy, and it has good proximity to transmission to get power to load. And so in the case of wind projects, the technology is increasing where you can use effectively the same footprint but get more generation as you have improved machine heads that can crank out more power than what you originally installed. And with shorter depreciation lives, say 20 years or so for a wind project, you can actually look over the long term and look at some significant increases in efficiency and value out of just the ownership or access to that site.
So, Senator Gerard?
Yeah, I have to go back to the actual carbon reduction, and I got to ask this question. I apologize. But, I mean, if you plug into the wall socket, there's no way to tell where the electron came from. You're not shutting down your plants in Wyoming. So I'm having a real dickens of a time trying to figure out how that's going to reduce carbon in Oregon. I mean, that just doesn't...
Yep. Senator Gerard, it's a great question. It's one that, you know, we have walked through with folks, and I think, you know, it's a conversation we continue to need to have because we do have emerging public policies like the Clean Power Plan that do envision not necessarily closing all fossil fuel plants or even every coal plant, but using those plants less and relying on those as you incorporate more renewable energy and energy efficiency into the grid. There's a value there when you certainly that baseload power is important to the reliability and ensuring that you have a high power quality to your system, but also there's an enormous fuel cost benefit that comes along as you look at the rising costs of coal and the regulation of coal and the volatility of natural gas. And so as you add more renewable resources, really the costs in the past of renewables have just been the capital costs. It's the cost of the machine. But the costs of operating the machine and what goes into it are extremely low to non-existent. And so for us, the value of the equation is if you look at technology costs coming down where these are more cost-effective versus traditional resources, and you look at the federal production tax credit, which is effectively a 30% discount off the top of what things cost today, renewables are extremely competitive. And again, with that fuel cost savings that you can achieve as you back down and use those other plants less and integrate them together, that's a value for customers. That is how we intend to keep costs affordable for our customers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gerard, great question. I think what I'd like to say are a few things. One, we testified at the Utility Commission on the 29th of January that we run our fairly complex model around rates and how plants will turn off and on in the West, called dispatch model, to try to analyze whether we're going to get any carbon reductions out of this program. And so a couple things will happen as we've sort of analyzed that. One, as you look at just adding more renewables, and Scott mentioned this earlier, what happens is you turn off other stuff. And so our analysis showed that across the West, as Oregon adds more renewables, and this was for the whole bill, so it would be both utilities additions, that would result in about 30 million tons of carbon reductions across the West. The second thing I'd say is you're always measuring against what you otherwise would do. So we're talking about the future, right? We're trying to assume how we're going to meet energy needs and what carbon would be associated with those needs into the future. And so the assumption on what's the least cost, lowest risk resource between now and then without some carbon regulation is likely natural gas, baseload natural gas plants. And so renewables compared to those get you carbon reductions, and that's why for PGE that puts us on that trajectory to meeting Oregon's goals. And then the last thing I'd say just about the coal plants, we're a part owner. The coal strip power plant in Montana, eastern Montana, has about 2,400 megawatts in four coal units. We own 20% of two of those units, the two newest units that were built in 1984. And those, as a 20% owner of two units that where we have six other owners in the project, I guess as a state, you can do what you can do. It's pretty hard to tell the other five when that the contract for operating that plant is essentially kind of a unanimous consent type of contract that we're going to shut it down here from Oregon when we only have that small sliver. And so Portland General Electric, when we did own a majority share of a coal plant, which was Boardman, and at the, right now we own 90%. At the time we had 65. We moved forward based on regulations coming down the pike and the cost they would have imposed with a closure plan as the best plan for consumers at that time. And so you, we do what we can do, but we feel very strongly this bill does, compared to business as usual and what we otherwise think we would do, it does reduce carbon in the West.
Dave, for Colstrip, then you're also dealing with pressure from Washington State and Vista and Puget to shut those some of those down. I don't know which of the four, but
now, Mr. Chair, I can't comment too much on that because I'm not spending more of my time here than in Olympia this last couple months. But I know that there have been some legislative proposals up in Washington that would enable Puget Sound Energy to own more of that coal plant than they already do. They own half of the first two units and 30% of the other units, or one of the other units.
They want to buy 30%.
Yeah, they don't. They just own the first two. So, like I say, you can already tell I don't exactly know what I'm talking about. So I should probably stop there. There has been some talk of that up in Washington.
Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to talk, go back to the decommissioning of wind farms. And it's my understanding that at the time of construction, there's bonding, which would cover that decommissioning cost. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, yes, that's correct. Those costs are built into the overall cost of the plant. We assume whatever kind of plant we have that we're going to have to shut it down someday, and those will be costs that kind of get wrapped into the whole plant costs. And so, I was chair of our homeowners association for a while, and we had to carry this fund that would replace the fencing around the common areas and things like that. It's a little bit like that, where you've got to carry those costs now, knowing that you're going to have that cost in the future.
So the bonding at construction time takes care of maintenance and deconstruction, that kind of costs.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you.
Senator Denver?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And, I would agree that the Dash 41 amendments are very important in keeping this bill moving. I'm wondering, from the utility's perspective, the lowering of the cap from 4% to 3%, is that something that you can work with? Given we heard from the chair that, the 4% in the RPS, we've never hit that. This is a different program. Just looking forward, I wonder if you could comment on that.
Chair Beyer, Senator Dumbrough, I think, none of us know what the future holds, whether that's the right cost cap, whether it's too high or too low. But I think we can all agree, those of us who have worked with this policy since 2007, is that we got this part of it right, and we're not sure why changing it advances the policy now. We know that, certainly the going in and changing that at this point actually doesn't have impact on the policy we're talking about, which is essentially a post-2025 RPS, but it could impact the RPS today and compliance between now and 2025.
So could you follow up? Could you describe the downside a little more?
The downside, I believe, Senator, would be if, we are at a time of historic lows in natural gas prices, and so you could have a situation where you have extremely low natural gas, you have a demonstrated need for additional energy resources, and say the production tax credit isn't available, or you have maybe not as much price decline as we've seen in the past with some of the renewable technologies, and you just would not be able to meet that next increment of the RPS because gas would be that much cheaper. So that 1% would be material in that scenario.
Senator Monroe?
You ready for a motion?
We're not in work session.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Watching the clock, Mr. Chair. Yeah,
I know.
Done.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Senator.
I'm not going to be able to get to everybody. Let's see if we can get How about I get some business folks? Let's get Mr. Jail Wilson, Mr. Fisher, and Tracy. Very quick. We're running out of time. Give you a shot.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Joel, not here.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I have another committee I've got to go to, so that will probably save me some time.
Thank you, Doug.
Thanks, Doug.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing industrial customers of Northwest Utilities and the Northwest Food Processors Association. We remain principally opposed to House Bill 4036. We project it would increase cost by $8.2 billion on ratepayers for the acquisition of renewable infrastructure, which is costly, ineffectual in terms of changing the dispatch of coal, and of course we object to the process that has got us here to this point. But all of that being said, we do acknowledge the Dash 41s are a significant step forward for our clients, better for ratepayers, particularly in some of the real significant things that we have talked about and brought to your attention, including the treatment of expiring production tax credits. Some of the competitive barriers that existed in the previous iteration of the bill appear to be scaled back, which we also do appreciate. Changing of the cost cap and restoring the current system of banking recs is also, I think, important. So do acknowledge that the Dash 41s are a far better product than the House bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Joel? Cities, whoever, be
Thank
quick.
You. I can be quick. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Tracy Renton, League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify very briefly on the bill today. We very much want to extend our appreciation for the Dash 41 amendments. I would agree with JL and say that those are a step in the right direction, absolutely. We had some significant concerns with the bill in the original version and as well as the Ann Gross version. Specific concerns in the bill that impact our ability essentially to use BPA lowest-priced hydropower for municipal electric utilities. Essentially, there's an exemption that exists in statute under ORS 469A060 that says that we do not have to meet the full RPS to the extent it would require us to reduce available BPA hydro. The bill in the original version and Ann Gross version had eliminated that exemption in certain scenarios where we acquire or form a new municipal utility without consent from the essentially the investor-owned utility. We think that the Dash 41s definitely takes a step in the direction to address that concern. We have maybe some technical issues that we've talked to the chair about and are hopeful to continue to work with him on addressing any of those outstanding issues. But we thank you for the effort, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher on behalf of Oregon Business Association. We're a statewide association with businesses all across Oregon, both large and small. I'm here to testify in support of this bill. We have an environment committee made up of business people all across Oregon that come and look at these issues much in the same way you do, and they have voted to support this plan. It's very important that this plan make sure that a ballot measure does not go forward, we're here to urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Hemingway, I have to give you a chance. Former PUC commissioner, former chair of the PUC. We're short on time, Roy.
I understand. I'll summarize my testimony. For those of you who don't know me, I was chair of the PUC. It's energy advisor to three governors on the Northwest Power and Conservation Council and chair of the New Zealand Electricity Commission. One of the watchwords of my career has been to follow the analysis. Let the technicians do the analysis and then vet it in public and go from there. We haven't seen the analysis that backs up this bill. It hasn't been done in public. The PUC says they do not have enough information to conduct that analysis, and so I would say at best this bill is premature. I'd ask you to look, if you have it in front of you, my testimony on page 3, which shows the what happens when we have a very cold day in Oregon. In fact, west-wide, when we have a cold day, there's no wind. The result is that what happens when we increase the renewable portfolio standard is not only that we build wind plants, but we also build gas-fired generation to back up that wind. And so essentially we end up building two sets of generators to serve the same load. On the next page, you'll see what happened during the warmest days of last summer. There was no wind. So the rest of the system has to come up to meet it, and that means gas-fired power plants. Storage works very well for moving generation from 1 hour to the next, moving it throughout the day. So far, we have an embedded storage that allows us to move energy from one day to the next. We've used up the capacity of the hydro system to do that. We've talked a lot among energy analysts about diversifying wind so that we aren't all in the Columbia Plateau. In Oregon, that probably means the coast or southeastern Oregon. If you want to vote to put wind on the scenic Oregon coast, be my guest. And in southeastern Oregon, my guess is that the moment someone proposes wind and new transmission, there'll be a listing of the sage-grouse to prevent it. With respect to rate increases, this does concern me very much. PGE at the PUC hearing said they expected this bill to cost 1.5% a year. 1.5% a year, when you compound it through the life of the bill, ends up with a rate increase over and above all other rate increases of over 40%. PGE's rates are already about average in the nation. This would put us up in the upper tier. When you compare the costs of that against what the total revenue would be raised, which is about somewhere between $700 and $800 million as a result of this bill in 2040, against the actual carbon benefit, you end up with a carbon cost of somewhere between $350 and $800 per ton of CO2 if you want to do that math. Now, absolutely nobody has suggested that carbon dioxide reduction should cost $350 to $800. Most of the carbon tax proposals have been in the range of $10 to $40 a metric ton of CO2, not in the range of $400 to $800. Now, I didn't come here to oppose this bill because I think that we don't know enough to know whether this bill is either technically feasible or how much it will cost. One of the things you should know is you don't have to do this now. Making decisions about 2040 for a power system where the lead time for these plants is at 3 to 5 years isn't necessary. You could wait easily 5 years to make this decision. And I think that an initiative that raises rates by 40% and doesn't shut coal plants isn't likely to pass, in my opinion. So I would, if you have that opportunity, to postpone this bill until the folks who are proposing an initiative that you'd like to wait, you'd like to consider this bill after all the analysis is in, and ask them to wait for all the analysis to be in, I think that that would be the better course of action. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Roy. And Mayor, what's your name? Gamba, are you here? Oh, there we are. Thank you. Welcome, Mayor.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, committee members. For the record, my name is Mark Gamba. I'm the mayor of Milwaukee, and the testimony I'm about to give is my own. This has been such a fast-moving bill that it's hard to get a city council to pass a resolution to support the ever-changing bill. That said, I want to say that I think the amendments that you've offered are solve some of the problems I saw with the bill initially. My opinion is that this bill doesn't move far enough nor fast enough. I think I would have to agree with the PUC that that a cap and trade or cap and invest bill is critical to this process, and that this bill does mesh well with it. I don't think they're at odds with one another, but I do think that the overarching control on carbon is more critical. I think there's been a little bit of a false argument on the economics of this. It's a foregone conclusion that over the next half a century we will not be burning any more coal in this country or probably the world. It's going to be the states that get ahead of that curve, the states that invest in renewables early, that take advantage of that fact. I think it's important for Oregon to be a leader. It's important for Oregon to show that we can do things without hurting our ratepayers, that actually indeed protect our ratepayers in the future, both from the sense of the damaging effects of climate change and the fires you mentioned, which are only being increased by climate change, and from the costs of having to get out of coal in a hurry and do something else.
Yeah, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up. I'm running out of time. Any questions to the mayor? Thank you very much for coming down today.
Thanks.
That is all the time we have for public input, and we're at the end of the session day, so I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 4036A.
What's the amendment?
-41.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move the -841 amendment to House Bill 4036A.
Senator Rudd's moved the -41 amendment to House Bill 4036A. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? There's none. It's adopted.
Rod, you can make the motion.
Move 4036 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe has moved House Bill 4036A as amended by the -41 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion.
I just think there's more economical ways to do it than what we're doing. It's therefore it'll be a no.
Senator?
I just got a quick one. I think we've heard plenty of testimony and seen this bill move, come to the legislature kind of outside the system, in no amendments at all on the House side. If it wasn't for you, Senator Beyer, and I commend you for doing this, this bill probably wouldn't have got amended at all. I think we've heard enough testimony that bills like this shouldn't happen in a short session. In a normal long session, we'd have 3 more months to work on this bill, and really we're just getting started working on this bill. This is the first day that we've worked on amendments, and I think maybe if we had 3 more months, we could get there, but in my mind, I could get there. My problems with it were I didn't see any reduction in coal usage at all, carbon footprint. We heard from no, with all these amendments, we heard from no really environmental groups that supported this. On the other side, that testified that I heard, maybe I was out of the room, but I'll probably be a no.
Let's call the roll.
Okay. Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Vice Chair Gerard?
No.
And Chair Beyer?
Aye. House Bill 4036A, as amended by the -41s, is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass.
I'll carry.
No, you won't. Fire
away. You didn't say who was going to carry.
He's going to. The chair's going to carry.
I had a feeling the chair. We were ahead of you.
I know where we were going from the start.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
Fred.
But we didn't get him. Yes,
Fred.
But we didn't.